So our final speaker is Bronwyn Hayward, and the title of her paper is Rethinking Sustainability for a New Generation, Understanding the Implications of Youth Struggles for Citizenship, Agency, and Freedom.
Implications of a new generation's struggle for citizenship, political agency, and freedom, and what it means for our ideas about sustainability. This work is part of a book I've been writing while I've been on fellowship with Resolve on children, environment, and citizenship, thinking about the reasons for nurturing a democratic imagination in a dynamic world. And I'd really like to take a minute to thank Resolve and Tim. I'm not sure if they quite knew what they were taking on when they offered me this time, but the 3 years shared here and with the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change have been fantastic. Young citizens growing up today inherit a world confronted by four difficult and intersecting challenges: dangerous environmental change, growing socioeconomic inequality, weakening democracies, and a pattern of global economic growth and investment that's delivered record levels of youth unemployment while extracting resources beyond the limits of our planet. But given this panel is about transitions and presumably also transformations, I'd like to argue that we can alter these grim and complex trajectories. But to achieve significant change will require much more than behavioural nudges or understanding social practice. It requires rethinking our basic principles of our democracies, our economies, and our societies, including our ideas about citizenship and sustainability, which I want to focus on here. But it will also require significant political struggle. However, I begin my argument by acknowledging that I'm currently standing on very shaky ground. As a family, we returned to New Zealand after 3 years in England at 12:50 on the 22nd of February this year. At 12:51, Ruamoku, the god of earthquakes, unleashed his terrible energy, devastating our home city of Christchurch. Since then, a complex series of fault lines has triggered a wave of aftershocks, including the very serious earthquakes this week. I probably should title this or subtitle this talk, How I Got to the Same Position as Juliet Through an Earthquake. But New Zealand's head of the Reserve Bank, Alan Bollard, has described the first earthquakes in Christchurch as one of the biggest natural disasters in relative terms to befall an OECD country since World War II. Over 180 people were killed in 1 minute on the February the 22nd out of a community of 300,000, including many of our international students. And while it's neither helpful nor possible to compare disasters, economists estimate that as a proportion of New Zealand's domestic economy, the impact of the Christchurch quakes has been twice that of the disastrous cascade of events that hit Japan 3 weeks later. I presume they're not including radiation, and they certainly weren't including the $5 billion worth of damage it's estimated to have been done on Monday. Certainly after 12 weeks of working from a tent, I must say the experience of daily life in a small disaster zone is both extraordinary and humbling. So my Turanga Waewae, or my place to stand today, is in part our home, a small provincial city in a small country struggling with an enormous challenge. However, yesterday I also swore an oath of allegiance to the United Kingdom. As one of its newest dual citizens, I promise to uphold her democratic values. And living between two worlds, I've been struck by the similarities between the experiences of earthquakes and the policies of austerity, both of which have the potential to devastate the life chances of a generation of young citizens. Whenever significant environmental change threatens a community, whether it's a series of slow, cumulative, almost imperceptible changes, like a change in climate, or a sudden cataclysmic event like an earthquake, these challenges test more than our physical infrastructure. They tear at the fabric of our economies, our democracies, and our citizenship. Yet in the grief of disaster comes opportunity for new insight, to rethink basic principles about what really matters. And today, I'd like to open a discussion about rethinking sustainability and to ask, what values and priorities are we seeking to sustain? In whose interests and why? Today's 1.2 billion teenagers face a future that's very different from their parents and their grandparents. UNICEF's recent 2011 report on the state of the world's adolescents reminds us that while we've made some remarkable gains in the lives of very young children, particularly around infant mortality and child immunisation, by comparison, we've largely ignored the situation of the world's teenagers. In the Middle East alone, 65% of the population will be under the age of 25 within the decade. UNICEF estimates that in order for the average 13-year-old to grow up in that region and be employed when they're 23, we will need to create 6.5 million new jobs every year for the next 10 years, presuming we adopt a business-as-usual economic model. Here in the UK, youth unemployment has reached record levels, blighting the prospects of a generation who already face the highest rates of father-to-son income immobility recorded in the OECD. For the first time in many generations, many of the world's children may face a future that is more limited than their parents. Yet much of our contemporary debate in sustainability seems disturbingly disconnected from this reality facing young lives. Our debates are framed around the issues of conserving or valuing ecosystem services, or framed in the language of social psychology and liberal paternalism, focused on barriers to citizen engagement. The received view is that the public is helpless, and that the public is in denial, and that about the threats to our climate and our ecological systems. I find it fascinating that the complaint that people cannot or will not engage with the long-term threats of sustainability is the same complaint that the Meadows team made in 1972 in Limits to Growth. And interestingly, the dissenting voice in that debate was Donella Meadows, and I often wonder whether they would have continued that trajectory of arguing that the community cannot engage in long-term thinking about sustainable issues if she'd lived. I fear we may endanger, because what really strikes me as fascinating about that conclusion is how could they have written that, writing as they were in the middle of some of the biggest human and civil rights revolutions the world had seen for generations? And I suggest that we're in the danger of making the same mistake again. Last week, for example, the New York Times columnist Tom Friedman argued that we are a population in denial, that we don't engage with long-term challenges embedded in sustainability. He echoes the concerns of thoughtful colleagues, Clive Hamilton's Requiem for a Species, Anthony Giddens describing it as the Giddens paradox, that people put off the difficult issues of the long term. Yet right around the world, from Tunisia to Spain, from Greece to London, to the liquefaction that currently covers the pavements of my hometown, young citizens are on the streets taking action now. I argue that we don't need to engage them with issues of sustainability or change their behaviours as much as we need to listen to what they're saying. The sea change in youth politics is focusing attention on skyrocketing youth unemployment, declining access to education, and limited opportunity for citizen voice in decision making. In short, the world's teenagers are already mounting strong, active protest about the complex long-term social and economic drivers which threaten to destabilize our climate, increase social inequality, and degrade our environment. So what's wrong with the way we currently frame sustainability and citizenship? I'd like to argue, although I fear it makes me sound a little like a green Scrooge, that quite a lot is, actually. I feel very uneasy at reports lauding yet another wonderful study showing how great the outdoors is for kids, like Grist's last week's title, How to Get Your Kids to Become Environmentalists. It's not that I've got any problems with kids being outdoors. In fact, I think that outdoor active and unstructured play is really essential. But my concern is the way we're depoliticising the sustainability agenda, teaching our young citizens to be enthusiastic, obedient, green volunteers, armed to change light bulbs and recycle waste, rather than to think critically and act politically to challenge corrupt or inequitable use of power and the exploitation of people and their environments. News this week that the UK school curriculum may move back to basics in science, shifting emphasis from issues like climate change, doesn't give me any reassurance. To make matters worse, while Britain has led the world in citizenship education since the Crick Report, emphasising on learning about citizenship by doing citizenship, the Minister of Education has recently announced that the citizenship education branch in focus may shift now away in favour of technological and skills-based learning for a global economy. It would be a tragedy if the UK became a second chapter in Joel Westheimer's damning report on US education with the delightful, if alarming, title, No Child Left Thinking. It's disturbing to reflect for a minute on the different receptions that three youth campaigns have had. Take, for example, I'll skip those for a second, put it down to Quake Brain, we kind of forget the things we were going to talk about, move on to something else. Take, for example, the difference between the reception of the 10-10 campaign, widely heralded, supported by government departments, yet I argue it changes very little, unless you really think that planting carrots on your balcony is the answer. By contrast, students who ostensibly raise similar concerns, protesting about coal or university fee hikes, but do so in a way that challenges the justice of power structures, face increasingly restrictive state sanctions. Instead of being endorsed by government, they find themselves spied on or detained or kettled for hours as they go about lawful protest. Given the extent of resistance to youthful challenges to our dominant framings of sustainability, it's humbling that young citizens are prepared to engage in political action anyway, or to embark, as Hannah Arendt movingly described, in acts of natality or political imagination towards as yet unrealised possibilities. The new energy of youth political agency reminds us that when individuals act as citizens, they act in ways that are fundamentally and importantly different. Contemporary citizenship is not driven by self-actualization or the quest for novelty so much as a quest for freedom, expressed as the desire to make a difference. Whether that action, this is the reception for the university fees protest, whether that action is projected in ways, for instance, turning to my students in the hometown of Christchurch, Sam Johnson and five other students within 6 days were communicating with 24,000 students and organised a massive campaign to clean up the streets of Christchurch and particularly to deal with liquefaction, which has become the common term that we all know about now, the seas of mud and water that surround and fill our homes. Or it's the... or whether we're talking about the phenomenal youthful energy and rapid growth of the UK Uncut campaign, challenging the social justice of austerity. Both of them are examples of that desire to make a difference. At Resolve, Tim Jackson, David Evans and I interviewed more than 300 members of the so-called shopping generation, current and recent higher education students and graduates from professional family backgrounds. I think I'm going to flick the slide on for a second. I'll just leave this one. It's the last. From professional backgrounds who grew up during the credit boom of the 1980s and 1990s. They weren't particularly green as a cohort, ranking a 2 out of a possible 5 of a combined index of interest and engagement and environment. But we were struck by several things when we were undertaking this survey in conjunction with the United Nations Environment Programme. When questioned about their hopes, fears and dreams, these respondents revealed surprisingly modest aspirations of material security, closer personal relationships, and fulfilling rather than high-flying employment. Secondly, what was also striking was that when asked to describe their worst ways of living, these young adults were most concerned about loss of freedom, expressed as loss of human rights or loss of personal agency. The ability to make a difference on things that matter to me was the refrain that was often used. This desire to make a difference and to express freedom through agency was noted in all the 20 countries and the 8,000 students and young professionals from New Zealand to Egypt surveyed in the study. But what, thirdly, was particularly moving for me about the British cohorts, especially when I was undertaking a comparison with the New Zealand students in the same survey, was how outward-looking young British graduates were. Certainly a significant proportion of the group talked about sustainability as self-provision or self-sufficiency, but the majority were also concerned with wider issues of their world. Yet they appeared to be hampered from engaging with their desire to effect change because of their high daily stress. Despite ranking their life satisfaction overall at an 8 out of 10, the British students wrote movingly about everyday struggles with exam pressure, with a sense of competition, with long hours of work or commuting, their sheer loneliness and their concerns about financial insecurity. Viewed in this context, we were struck by the fact that offering policy responses as a toolkit of sustainable actions seems woefully inadequate, or as one respondent memorably described, pathetically trivial. What these young adults needed and wanted was access to education, opportunities for secure, flexible conditions of work, opportunities to collaborate and work with others to achieve something meaningful. If, as a society, we wish to support young citizens to fulfil their life potential and release their political agency, which is a significant driver for sustainable transitions, our first steps might be to include rethinking our employment and social policies in a way that reduces the stress of long hours of study or work, addresses financial insecurity and the sheer loneliness reported by so many British teenagers. But these concerns are not currently the priority of the way sustainability is framed by the baby boom generation. Conservative politician David Willetts speaks in his book The Pinch of stealing from our children. His work reminds us that the political clout of the baby boomers at the ballot box has set the political agenda on a range of issues, including sustainability. It's the baby boomers who have benefited from the low-cost home loans, from free state education in the New Zealand situation, from years of low inflation, the ability to travel, the networks that that builds up, the ability to export widely, from the timing of the shift of public to private funding, from the way in which pensions are invested. Willetts argues that the baby boomers have failed to invest in the future assets and infrastructures of the world of our children. As an older generation, we have the ability and privilege of reflecting backwards and looking forwards. While I agree with Willetts up to a point, I disagree on some fundamental aspects of his conclusion, which I want to just raise as I close. I think Willetts overlooks some of the most significant sacrifices, contributions, and investments the baby boom generation has made for our children's future. One is the women's rights movement, which has ensured that a generation of young girls and women are educated, a legacy that is good for the environment and for citizen flourishing. Another is the civil rights movement, not just about immediate conditions of work or life for minority communities, but envisaged as a different future. Yes, we can and should engage in a range of legacy decision-making. We can develop political commitment devices such as taxation arrangements, pension schemes, constitutional amendments like creating commissions for future generations, all of which might help shift the environmental, social and political burdens we currently place on children back to our lives. But, and it was interesting that Juliet mentioned about the 1970s movements when she came back, I think to transform the trajectory we need, and to avoid the mistakes of the Limits to Growth group, we need to challenge not just dangerous environmental change and growing socioeconomic inequality through policy action, but we as baby boomers need to reclaim both the language and thinking of sustainability in ways that support the current political struggles of our children. Nō reira, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa.